I'll declare it's 1 o'clock. We're back on the record. The matter of FRM. On the witness stand is Mr. Donald Dodge. When we broke for lunch, Mr. Forcier indicated that he was ready to go forward with, I believe, his final segment of questioning. Attorney Forcier, are you ready?
I am.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. I believe, Mr. Dodge, we were talking about the prepaid interest prior to our break. We were talking about the interest paid prior to the closing. Just to reiterate, and I apologize if we're reiterating this too many times, but to your knowledge, in 2009 is the only time when you would learn of interest being paid to lenders prior to closing?
That's all that I can remember, but I, in the back of my mind, I believe that he may have done that with a one or two clients in the years preceding it, but only rarely, and I don't recall it. I couldn't tell you who it was. I'm just telling you I knew of the concept when he told me and explained it to me. But I did not, I don't believe much of it occurred prior to 2009.
Okay. And I believe you said that you were not aware of FRM being cited for use of your company as an unlicensed servicer?
No.
Did you ever have, were you ever privy to any meetings with Scott Farah and any of his attorneys regarding issues from banking examinations?
I don't think so. I don't recall ever sitting in a meeting regarding banking. He had called me down on occasion, said he had to supply the banking commissioner something, and there may have been some pieces of paper or something he wanted from me, and I might have supplied it, but that I don't recall it. I don't remember the details of it, but I don't remember setting into a meeting with attorneys and other people discussing the issue.
I want to talk to you about the unclosed loans.
Yeah.
We spoke about this at length during our past interviews. How many loans at the close of FRM, prior to reading any statements by Mr. Farah, what was your understanding of the situation with respect to unclosed loans in 2009?
I believed in that there were probably four or five or maybe even six large loans that had not closed.
And how much money do you think was tied up in unclosed loans at that time?
I would have thought something in the neighborhood of $5 million, $6 million, you know, certainly less than $10 million.
At that time, were you under the impression that the lenders in those transactions were, in fact, receiving interest, even though they had not closed?
Yes, I believe that that was true.
Do you remember any lenders who may not have been receiving interest for those unclosed loans?
I had nothing to do with those loans, so I don't know. I wouldn't know.
We discussed a scenario that you said happened frequently in the last 6 months of the operation before it ceased in November 2009. Where Diane would approach you because she was concerned about an unclosed loan?
Because she'd getting calls from a lender who was saying, where is the closing papers? And she would say, I don't know, Mr. Sue, whoever you are. He may have said to her on the phone, Scott told me it was going to close next week. And that was 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or whatever it might be. And she said, I can't answer the question. I don't know. You'd have to talk to Mr. Farah. And the person might be irritated with talking to Mr. Farah. This is what occurred in that last 6 months. It was a considerable amount of this, in which the person didn't want to talk to Scott Farah, wanted her to find out. And she said, well, I'll do my best. I'll ask him. So she would talk to Scott. He would give her an answer, either that he was going to call the person himself or that the closing was going to occur very shortly. A week would go by, 2 weeks would go by, the person would call again. She would come in to me and she said, I don't want to go down and talk to Scott again. I would like you to go and talk to him. I said, well, I'd like for us to both go talk to him. Write up whatever it is, there's a situation, bring a summary so that we can, I want it clear to Scott that this person's upset and that he needs to take care of it, whatever the problem is. We would go down together. Scott would, as I now know he can come up with any kind of answer that he wants. But he did. He came up with answers that were made sense. He would say something like, I've got to take care of this one. Don't worry about it. I will call them. But this one and this one are going to close. This one is going to close in 2 days. This one's going to close in 7 days or something like that. And he would do that each time. And I would say that I probably went down 3 times over the six-month period because of her frustration. And then on maybe a few other occasions, talked with him on the phone and said, Diane is extremely upset. She's getting a call from so-and-so. You did not return the call to him. And Scott would say, yes, I did, but he didn't take the call or something like that. Anyway, that's when it occurred. This was not an... I never heard of this happening before or never had
any... Before or when?
I'm talking in the previous years. That had never been an issue.
So you only became aware of this situation of the unclosed loans and the lenders calling in 2009?
That there was a problem, but never even then did not know that the problem was 3 full pages of lenders that were on this list and that the amount came to something like $18 million or some horrific number.
$18 million in unclosed loans?
That's what I was told by the FBI.
Okay.
And that's what the transcript said that I read of what Scott said about it. Before that, I would never have imagined it. I wouldn't have thought it possible.
I understand these meetings happened where Diane would approach you, and you together would approach Scott.
Yeah.
But were you aware prior to 2009 that there was delays in closing some transactions?
All because of the issue. If they were condominium issues, and that's not just in New Hampshire. That was many states had problems with condos. That if you were closing a condo, you had to provide something to the Attorney General's office or some special office that had to review the thing, and it would hold up the closings. But what Scott told me was that in the case of Tangway, they were able to continue their construction project. Everything was on schedule. They just couldn't record the loans until they had that happen. And there was a measure of risk that if the thing didn't finish, if they didn't get the approval of the entity that they were trying to get approval from, there was a risk that people would be, I don't even know what the risk was, but that there was some risk there.
Were the lenders aware that when they did the transaction for, say, Tangway Homes, that their instrument would not be recorded for what I think turns out to be 15 months?
It was a long time. Nobody would have thought it. I was told that it is probably a 3-month process, a 6-month process. I think Ed Walters, or Waters, whatever his name is, was the attorney. I talked to him a couple of times, and he said, oh, I just filed the final papers for it. It should happen very shortly.
But were the lenders aware when they closed, or were they aware when they forwarded their money to CL&M that loan would not close for well over a year?
Nobody.
What were they told when they first transferred that money?
That it was going to close.
And when it became apparent to you that it wasn't closing after several months go by, did you ever notify the lenders and have discussions with them?
I never had any conversations regarding closings. It wasn't anything that I had anything to do with. I didn't have any responsibility for a loan until it closed. So we didn't participate in the closing process.
But you were aware that Tangway was languishing?
Only because of people calling and asking why their loan hasn't closed. And then when Scott explained it, I would explain it. If Scott didn't get to talk to that person and they called a second time, I would explain what Scott had told me. And some would ask, I don't remember exactly if it was Tangway or some other case, what can I do? And I would say something like, you can withdraw from the loan, you could foreclose, you can't foreclose on something that hasn't closed, but I would just tell them what I thought, and I'd tell them that they really need to talk to their attorney if they wanted to go beyond that.
So were there instances where people said, yeah, I want to get out. I'd like to move somewhere else, and their money would be moved to a different transaction?
You'd have to talk to Scott. It's possible.
Still staying on the Tangway project here. You, and I'm not sure if you testified about this earlier today or if it was during our interview, but at one point you told me that the account ran into the deficit, ran into below zero, into negative numbers on that particular account. Tell me how you became aware of that and when it happened.
Well, it was like 10 days before it all closed. I had a check bounce for $25,000.
That was your checking account balance?
No, the check was written for $25,000 and
And it balanced. I thought you said balanced.
And it balanced, yeah. And I called up Scott and said, something is very wrong.
But you must have seen this coming if you're the one who monitors the CLNM checking accounts and you see the balance dropping over a period of time, nearing its worst points. You said earlier, the lowest you'd ever had it, so that's why you were concerned. You must have seen this coming.
Well, no. I mean, seeing it coming, I did not spend my days looking at the Excel sheet. That took 5 minutes of my time to give a number to Scott off the phone. He would call me up and say, what is the balance? What is, did you get the so-and-so money in, the $300,000 from so-and-so? He would just ask me questions. I would look on the sheet, give it to him, and I went back to my work. So I wasn't sitting there looking at this thing. I just wasn't looking at it. It wasn't something that I spent any time on. Diane had the accounting going on in the other room, which said what every account had, and that's where all the calls came from, is how much do I have in my account? What is the balance of the construction account?
And I'm not talking about Tangway's balance in your spreadsheet. I'm talking about the commingled account.
The whole account.
How often did you see the balance in the Citizens Bank account?
I would at least see it one or two times a day.
And is it?
And that's because Scott would call up and say, what is the balance?
One or two times a day you would see it.
And I would be entering in checks. All the checks that came in, I had to enter them in, and then I would put them into the thing, and that would produce a balance, and then I would have all the checks that I had that went out. Anything that Diane wrote out, she gave me a summary, all the sheets that she had sent out, and then she had a gal that would actually summarize them so that I would have a number of what went out that day.
And you would update your spreadsheet accordingly. But I'm asking about the online checking account at Citizens Bank, separate from your spreadsheet. It was obviously you were getting that number and checking that number to make sure that the money you actually had in the account was accurately reflected with what's on the balance sheet.
Yes, and you couldn't really tell because what was going on at the bank was faster or slower than what I was doing. But yes, I would check the balance at the bank periodically, and I would check the. Really, what I was checking was not the balance at the bank. I was checking to see if the wires went out and to see if the wires came in. Because Scott would call and say, can you tell me, did so-and-so wire? Did you receive that wire? Did you make that wire? And I would check it then.
When do you remember the Tangway project on your spreadsheet entering into a zero deficit or entering into a negative deficit?
I don't remember ever Tangway going into a deficit.
Okay. Diane never told me during an interview or the interview that I listened to on tape that Tangway at one point had a negative.
That was Diane telling me that there was a negative, and when it was brought to Scott, he said that is all taken care of. He is applying for another loan using another property as collateral, and he is going to make up that deficit. The deficit will be taken out of there, and then also the future payments will be made from there.
So there, I want to talk about the transaction involving the other piece of land that you just mentioned about. At one point, Scott needed more funds, so what did he do? He applied for a loan?
Tangway needed more funds because it was dragging out too long, and he needed it for his payments, maybe for construction. I'm not sure what the purpose was. All I know is Scott said he was taking out another loan that was going to cover that deficit, so don't worry about it.
So there was a deficit with Tangway. But you weren't aware of it personally? You heard it from
I was told about it, and at the time when we went to check on it and to find out what was going to be done about it, that's when what Scott said.
Where was this other piece of land that Scott mentioned that he was going to use as collateral?
I assume it's somewhere here in Concord.
What makes you assume it's somewhere here in Concord?
Because he would often show, if we were in a meeting, there would be plots of land on these big, long sheets that him and Ease would discuss, and he would say, do you remember that piece of land? I didn't remember it.
Okay, so how was he going to use that second piece to finance the money needed
for
the first?
He was going to use it as collateral and find lenders for that, I guess, whatever way he was going to get funding, using that land as collateral.
I'm just trying to understand the concept of using that as collateral. So he was going to get other lenders to borrow money with an interest in the land in the event the money was not paid back?
I assume.
How do you assume, or do you know how he's going to pay the lenders their interest rates for that transaction?
I assume it would be built into the loan.
Into the Tangway loan?
Into the second loan.
Into the second loan.
Right, next loan, right.
I want to understand the relationship with Tom Hawley.
Yep.
How was Tom Hawley employed? Was he employed by FRM or CLNM?
He was employed, I guess, by Financial Resources to do inspections. However it was, we would pay, the inspections would be paid for out of each loan. So if an inspection was done and it was $250, then that $250 would come out of that loan of that project. That was part of the construction loan agreement. So I guess you could say it was, he was contracted. I never thought of it before. We just paid it was Scott's relationship with Tom that had him become the inspector.
For the subdivisions, weren't you charged with reviewing the disbursement requests?
I was trying to, I mean, in the beginning I didn't do any reviews. Scott did them all, supposedly. But then when we started having a lot of problems, we had a meeting with the attorneys, and I raised my hand and said, I guess I got to take on looking at disbursements.
You need to identify which attorneys you're talking about.
Talking about attorneys Gould and Burke, I think we're in the meeting. I'm not positive that both of them there, but one of them was probably there.
Give me a time frame on that meeting.
Yeah, it was probably around 2000, end of 2008, beginning of 2009, when I started to pay attention to disbursements, because I had never done it before.
Who would bring you the disbursement requests? How did it come into your possession?
It would be, usually it would be Vicki. It would come in from the borrower. Vicki was with us the longest, and she would bring in a disbursement request, or on occasion a loan officer would come in and say that he was called by the borrower and he wanted an immediate disbursement of some large sum of money. And I would say, has he supplied us with the information that we need? And most of the time he hadn't. Most of the time I'd give him a list of what he had to supply us. And then they would disappear. And then come back again and try to push a disbursement through.
Is it my understanding that you also reviewed these disbursements with Tom Hawley?
And I did. At the end, I needed his help. I didn't know what was good and what was bad. When I would see an estimate of expense on a construction project, and it showed $20,000 for flooring and $30,000 for plumbing and $60,000 for landscaping, siding, and other things, I didn't know if those numbers were reasonable or not. And then when they would go over one of those items, they were over budget on a particular item, then I forced them to tell me, where is it going to come from? And then that's when I got Tom, would have him come in and say, they're saying that they can cut down on their siding and cut down on these other costs, and therefore there's enough money to pay the rest of the electric bill. And Tom would explain that to me, and I became more knowledgeable and started to understand how it worked. And I still had to call him all the time because there was constantly large projects that I wasn't able to handle.
So he was not only the inspector on the job, but he was also aiding you in these draw requests.
Yeah.
And determining if they were fraudulent.
Yeah, just to give me an idea whether it made sense or not.
Did he work out of the FRM office? Did he have an office room there?
He just had a little trailer outside.
He had a trailer outside that was permanently left there?
That he used as his office.
When did that occur? When did he move his trailer up there?
I don't remember when it wasn't there, but probably 2-3 years, I just don't know.
Did you attend the grand opening at the Tangway project?
I attended one of the so-called open houses. In fact, I attended two.
How many were there?
Well, one of them was for the opening of the units that had been completed, and then the second one was because he had built a community house, which was about $1 million building. And he put up the community house, and on that he had an open house for that. The community house was going to provide a little, what do you call it, very small apartment, so that people who owned a condo could have guests come from out of town and be able to stay in this apartment in the community house. And that was part of it, and then they would have functions there, and I was there at that.
Did you ever get together with Scott and try to hash out ways that you could obtain more lenders?
Oh, yes.
Now, he, who else was
he always was coming up with ideas to obtain more lenders.
Who figured out the mailing that would be sent out?
I helped to edit that mailing that went out. I finally got it edited down to a postcard that was about half a page deep. That was the final thing. We tried full pages. We tried little teeny-weeny postcards. And when I say we, he would try these things, and then he would bring them up to Scott. Then he would bring them up to me and say, I don't really like this. What do you think? And so sometimes there'd be someone else that had some ideas, and they would suggest them. And so I would use my little page maker program and set up a postcard, a sample, and then send it down to him. If he'd probably change some words, and then send it over to the printer, and then he'd run off a run on them and then try it out. And the half-page postcard turned out to be the piece of choice, the marketing piece.
How did you decide who to send that to?
He had asked me to find a company that would research all the registry of deeds and look for people who had held paper on a sale of something for above $50,000 or had made a mortgage, a second mortgage, or above $50,000. Individuals, not corporations. And they did that search, and they found some 20,000 people. On the first mailing, they had come up with 20,000. I don't know if it was across the country or if it was a segment of the country, but he started doing 2,000 mailings per week, I believe, or every at least a month.
When did this postcard start?
I'm going to guess it was in... It could have been as early as 2004, but by 2005, the early part of 2005, it was, I would say, in working. That would be my guess, and it produced immediate results. Lots of folks came in because of
that. So it was successful.
It was extremely successful.
Was there any other, since you came along, and I believe it was 03, and your company, CLNM, in 05, was there any other ways in which Scott and you marketed for additional lenders besides beyond the postcard?
On one occasion, I made a list of people that I knew that might have investment money that were my clients, and sent out a letter to them saying that Scott was offering this program, they might want to take a look at it. That I did probably one time, and it wasn't very productive.
And it was a letter to all your prior clients, or your other businesses over the past decade?
Clients that I'd worked with for 40 years, some of them, and 20 or 30 years. Harry Bean was a part of that letter, but I think he had already was doing something. I don't even remember who else. Gene and Frank Caricelli, I think, were a couple that may have come up there because of that letter.
What familiarity do you have with the Apple Ridge project?
Not much, except that it's been a thing that's... There's more paper been generated about Apple Ridge than anything I can ever remember. It was constantly something new that was going on, something new that was being done. I had heard it was going to be an upscale apartment place at one time, and then it was going to be an upscale for half of it, and a low-end apartment buildings for another, and then I don't even know if they were talking about being a mobile home park or modular home park. I'm not sure all the things that it was going to be. And usually Mr. Brouillard would come in and talk with Scott, and they would hash out whatever. The last thing was that Mr. Brouillard was selling out his interest, albeit piecemeal or somehow through the trust, and we set up the trust for Susan to be, and that was the provincial, it was a name that Mr. Brouillard came up with, Provincial Park Realty Trust, I think it was.
What was the name of the trust that was initially set up for the Apple Ridge project?
I thought it was Apple Ridge Trust, but I'm not sure if there was. I didn't make it up, or I don't remember it.
Do you remember who the trustee was?
I don't.
Would it be possible that you or your company was the trustee?
Anything is possible.
But you have no recollection of being the trustee, nor your company, Dodge Financial?
I don't remember ever doing anything on behalf of the trust. I don't remember ever filing a K-1, don't remember filing anything. If it was done, it was done a one-time thing, and then I don't recall it ever.
You seem to to not recall a lot of things, and you told me several times that documents would be put in front of you and you would sign your name at Scott's direction.
That's right.
Are you of the opinion that Scott signed your name for you in any instances, or did he always bring the paperwork by you?
There's no reason for him to sign. I mean, he would bring it, stick anything in front of me and say, this is for this, and I'd say...
And without question, you would sign it?
I would sign it.
You testified several times that you were working with CLNM and were working for CLNM for the purpose of watching out for the lenders.
Yeah.
But then you tell me you would sign whatever came in front of you without question. That
right.
doesn't jive. How is that working for the lenders?
Well,
if you're not going to question...
Right. And if you have a fellow who has 20 family members that all trust him completely, 100%, and he comes to you and says, will you help me to service those 20 people that trust me 100%? And I say, sure. And he would say, I'm putting up together a trust for this group over here, another one for this group. I'll send up the papers. Would you sign those and be their trustee until they pick one? Sure. I mean, this is a man I trusted completely. I would have given him, I did. I gave him everything that I had, every penny I had, and I gave him my wife's money and my office manager and every person who asked me what did I thought. I thought it was the best thing I ever heard of. And I thought I was doing an excellent job and felt that I was helping to make it safer as I got to be better at it.
A couple of times during your testimony today, I feel like I've heard you allude that you have lost a lot of money yourself into this. Explain to me what you've lost financially.
It's minuscule compared to other people. If I got a bonus build-up of $50,000, I would have bought a mortgage. And Scott would just pick whatever you think. And my wife had $50,000 or $60,000 or $75,000 was all she had to her name after working 30 years with BAE. She put it all in there.
So all your bonus monies and other monies you had acquired, you just leave with Scott and have him invest?
I just said invest it.
Did you ever receive any documentation once you let Scott have that money?
I probably did. Yeah, but I would have just left it in the office. I would never.
Do you recall receiving paperwork for those monies?
I did, yeah.
I want to go back to Apple Ridge. I got a tangent there. So you think that the trust might have been called Apple Ridge Trust. Do you remember who?
It very likely was.
You don't remember who the trustees were or trustees?
It very well could be me.
But at one point you said it was transferred to Susan Farah?
I don't know how that happened. I don't know how it got from Apple Ridge into...
SMM?
No. Provincial Park Realty Trust. This was something that Goyard had made, created, or made up, and then from that he had to create a purchase and sale arrangement between Susan and Phil, or I believe that we did that, and I'm not sure there was a lot of paper created in Apple Ridge. That property was the subject of it all.
For in general, with the subdivisions that he got involved in, would it be common that he would have a blanket loan for the entire land and then separate transactions for individual units, and yet again second mortgages on those units as well? Is that typical?
That could be. That would be describing like Tangway, and that would be describing probably 5 to 10 large.
Like Apple
projects.
Ridge, like
I would think so.
Lilac Valley, Beaver Pond.
Yeah, Lilac Valley would.
They all had
make sense.
Blanket mortgages,
mm-hmm.
and then the units were individually mortgaged.
Yeah.
And then yet again, the units were also second mortgages, and sometimes even more.
I don't know about the seconds, but I know Tangway had seconds. I don't know about Apple Ridge or Lilac Valley.
What do you know about Lilac Valley? What do you recollect?
I just know that Larry Baldy and Scott were somehow partnership on the thing. And they were developing this piece of land and putting modular homes on it, and that they sold one or two houses is what I know about it.
They only sold one or two houses out of the whole development, and then it crashed with...
I think so, yeah.
Were you involved with the... No, we scratched that. The trust, was there a trust document by the name of Lawrence Baldy, Scott Farah Trust, LBSF Trust?
Is that the one that you
referred? There was, that, but it wouldn't be Scott Fair. I think he would have used Susan. He always put her name on anything.
So the LBSF was?
Was Susan Farrow.
Susan Farrow. And they were partners on some of these projects? Which projects do you remember them being partners on?
I don't know. There was quite probably, I'm guessing, three or four, maybe five. I remember there was a Moultonboro deal. I think, in fact, two things up in Moultonboro that I think the LBSF had something to do with.
Was the LBSF involved with the church properties?
I think so. Yeah, that was one of the properties.
Explain to me what you understand about that particular subdivision.
Well, it's my understanding that the church had this land and that it wanted to raise money to build a gym, and they were going to sell off this piece of land with that would be able to handle maybe 6 to 10 houses. I'm not sure how many. And that they built two houses, of which he asked me to be a straw buyer and buy them from the LBSF or Center Harbor, and I did on two.
So you bought the only two houses that were ever built?
That were built, and then one of them was sold off to an outside person who came in and bought the big one. And the other one, as far as I know, is still not really complete, never was finished on the inside.
So did you personally buy these, or did you use a company?
I personally purchased them.
Did you ever live in them?
But the little one I was going to live in, I was considering moving up there. That was in the days when my wife wanted us to be closer so I could come home quicker, and it never happened.
Why did Scott solicit, you tell me today that Scott had asked you to purchase the houses. Why would he do so?
Because he had private lenders on those loans that were charging, they were earning 13%, 14%, I don't know what the amount was. And if I would purchase them, then I could qualify for conventional financing and purchase the house. That would release those lenders from that loan and allow those lenders to go into other loans.
So that was the case for both transactions?
And it reduced the financial burden on the church or Scott or whoever was making the payments on it.
I want to get a time period of when this happened and when you purchased the house. Do you remember when the project was started?
I'm guessing it was in 2006, 2007 was the years of both houses.
You purchased both houses in 2007?
No, I don't know. It may have been 2006, one of them. It might have been 2007. They might have been both in 2007. They were 6 months or so apart.
Why weren't any other houses built? I know that FRM closed in November of 2009, so there's a couple of years have gone by with nothing else being done.
You'd have to ask Scott. I couldn't tell you.
At the time that FRM closed, did you own that smaller of the two houses still?
I did, yeah.
So for over 2 years it went unfinished?
They brought in the cabinets, and they brought in a whole bunch of stuff and then just left it. And the reason I knew, I didn't even know that, but the realtor came and said, can you get this to look good? He said, I almost had a buyer for it. So I told Scott, aren't you and Larry or whoever taking care of this and monitoring this? This is not finished, according to someone who just went in there. And it looked like the dickens. It was dust everywhere and what have you. So he said he was going to take care of it. I don't believe that he ever did.
So who was marketing the house?
It went to two or three different realtors. I remember one.
At whose direction? At your direction? Or you?
Well, Scott and Larry found the person and asked me to come down and talk with them. And
so after you owned the house, Scott and Farrer were still actively trying to market that house for you?
Yep.
Were they also trying to market the unbuilt lots?
I'm sure that he was.
So that's, okay. Well, so it goes for 2 years being unbuilt. Did you ever raise that question to Scott? Hey, I'd like to live here. My wife was thinking of
moving closer. I told him that I was considering it. And I said, my wife is really motivating me more than me wanting to do it. I actually prefer to have the half-hour drive home to my trailer in Belmont in my simple life. I'm not looking to create a lot of financial burden on myself. And I like the half-hour drive. She didn't care for it as much as I did. I actually liked it.
So as I understand it, the land was held in the Lawrence Baldy Susan Farrer Trust, and they were 50-50 partners on that particular subdivision?
I'm not positive. I don't know. I mean,
you just recall hearing that the LBSF trust
was
involved?
Yes, and I've met with Larry on occasion. He'd come in, and he was confused because there was two trusts. One of them was an LBSF investment trust, and one was an LBSF realty trust. And one of them functioned as a borrower, and one of them functioned as a lender, I think. I'm not even positive of that, or as an owner. And it was very complicated. And I tried to help him to do his tax returns. I remember meeting with I met with Larry on probably two or three occasions. He met with his accountant, brought his accountant into my office, and we went over it. And then the guy said he had it, he understood what it was, and then filed his taxes for him.
What do you know about the Good Earth Revocable Trust?
Other than I've seen the name over and over again, and I believe that it's connected to the Roller Coaster Road. But that's, and I believe that Michael Gould, an attorney, is the trustee. But apart from that, I don't know who owns it. I thought it was Larry, a deal with Larry and Scott again. And then every now and then I'd hear Gary Coyne. I don't know if he was involved with that project or something else. But I really didn't know who was in what. I understood they had built some houses. Because on one occasion I asked Scott, what is with that? Is there any houses built? He said, oh, yeah.
But he didn't give you any indication of how many houses were built or any other details?
No, I didn't. I wasn't that curious.
I want to go into the line of credit that you've been referred to.
Yep.
I have here in front of me a document that is already in evidence, Mr. Chandler. I have a copy for you now if you'd like it to refer to immediately. I believe you're aware of this document, Mr. Dodge. It's a discretionary line of credit agreement signed in 2005 for $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
We reviewed this document during our meetings.
I would like
to. Would you need a copy in front of you to refer to, or do you have enough understanding of it in memory?
I understand it. I mean, I understand what I created. I actually drew up the document.
Do you remember when you drew up the document?
It would have been in the beginning, sometime in 2005, very early on.
What was the purpose of that agreement?
Well, if you want the whole story, I've written it out because I was preparing to go to court the three issues that I was concerned about is one of them was the line of credit that I wanted to be understood.
Do you have a statement you wish to read into the record?
I'd be glad to, if you want.
Please.
I was told, the reason that I was, part of the reason I was disturbed was that I was told that Scott will say that he approached me with starting a loan servicing company. He said to me that he owed preferred stockholders $3 million. This is what I was told. Scott had told his attorney what he was going to say if he went into my hearing, if I went to court and defended myself. My reply is that Scott never told me there was $3 million of shareholders outstanding, but rather that it was $2 million and that he had already settled up over $700,000, and therefore the balance that needed to be settled up was $1,300,000. Scott will say that it was his and my plan from the beginning to use dollars from the loan servicing account to pay off the preferred lenders. And my reply is that Scott had planned in his head from the beginning, or I said what Scott had planned in his head from the beginning may have been to pay off those shareholders by drawing on his line of credit with CL&M. However, it was my understanding that Scott would concentrate on paying them off as soon as he could so as to not jeopardize his license, and meaning that he would pay it off from his commission income. It was my belief that he had a substantial amount of commission income coming in, plus many of those shareholders would be wanting to roll over into mortgages. It's also my understanding that most of them did choose to roll over into mortgages. None of this changes the initial purpose of setting up their line of credit. For months, and I believe it was late in 2004 or early 2005, Scott had been discussing with various lenders and or potential lenders about setting up a $1 million to $3 million line of credit with him. I even overheard some of the conversations on the telephone. I was in the office when some of those conversations were going on the telephone. During those conversations and his conversation with me, he would say something like he had often lost good quality borrowers to the competition that he would not have lost had he been able to close the loans more quickly. He would talk about losing a cream of the crop borrower, an A, which means an A plus borrower, with an extremely low LTV or a small loan request that would have been in big demand by a lot of lenders, and he had been able to close, had he been able to close it first and then offer it to the lender group later. None of this changes the fact that I am guilty of setting up the line of credit so that Scott Farrer would have access to short-term funds which would otherwise be sitting idle for many months and for what I thought would be used for good purpose. It is now clear that setting up this line of credit was a breach of my fiduciary responsibility as a custodian over other people's monies. And what makes it fraudulent behavior is that I did not reveal that important information about this arrangement to anyone so that they could make an informed decision as to whether they wanted to be involved with Scott or FRM or CLNM. Scott will say that when he approached me with starting the loan servicing company, that it would be set up in a way so that he could control the dollars and the paperwork, so that he could continue to steal from people like he had been doing for years. These are the words I was told by my attorney that he was going to say. My reply is pure baloney. If he had said or implied any such thing to me, I would never have trusted him, I would never have been able to recommend him to anyone, and I certainly would never have put my wife's money there or let anyone I care about, i.e. Harry and Priscilla Bean, Ronnie, his brother, Debbie, and Ronnie and Debbie Bean, his mom and dad, his sisters, his cousins, my closest friends, David and Diane Smith, Carol Symes, Jean and Fran Caricelli, Philip and Vudge Ambrose, all of those people I consider to be very dear, close friends. Never would I have let them put a penny in had Scott revealed to me that he was pulling a scam, that he was doing anything but building a very substantial loan servicing company, or not loan servicing company, building a very substantial mortgage company. And then I've got the whole issue of Tangway in here, and you can, I'll be glad to give it to you, and if you want me to read it, I'll continue.
I want to hear it.
All right. Scott will say that he knew, that I knew, that CLNM had been making over $6 million payments on behalf of Tangway. My reply, me, Donald Dodge, his reply to that is that Scott had said to both Diane and me that Tangway was going to and or had put up more property on two more occasions as collateral to fund his payments. I believed that was true, and I have never been shown otherwise. However, if that is not true, then it is only one more of the lies that I and others have been told. In addition, Scott supposedly said something that I knew the line of credit was being used to make payments to lenders like Tangway or others. My reply is, when Scott drew on his line of credit, I did not follow him around to see what he was doing with it or anything else he was doing. I didn't have time to second guess him or anyone else. Scott was the money genius. He was the founder of the company. He was the person that everyone trusted, especially the lenders, and the person that told me that he would show me when I had to do something and what to do at every turn. And he did. Scott had been servicing his own clients for over 15 years, and it was Scott that was holding and handling all of their dollars during those 15 years. These lenders trusted him, and so did I. At Scott's request, it was my goal and purpose to set up a servicing company in order to assist Scott by providing more accurate and efficient administration and paperwork for the sake of his lenders and borrower clients. I trusted him completely. I could not imagine he would ever do anything that might put me and or all the others that loved and trusted him all these years at risk of losing everything. Not only, you don't want to hear my Santa Claus. I'm just disgusted. This is where I was disgusted. I had a choice. I had a choice in doing what I did. I was about to semi-retire when I was asked to come aboard a ship that had a captain who said there was a few relatively small holes in it. I agreed to help fix the holes and without checking them out and to help make the ship more efficient. I now know I got aboard the Titanic after it had already hit the iceberg, and I foolishly welcomed aboard all my friends, my family, and we believed in the captain and the ship until it was going down. From his testimony, we learned that we were fools. Scott was the hub. Most every person I met in the company was a spoke. Although they were different size spokes, some of them were thin spokes, some of them were thick, and mine was probably the thickest spoke of all. Scott had a separate relationship with most everyone except a few support people. In most cases, no one knew what the other one was told or was doing except Scott. And I want to emphasize that none of this makes me an innocent man. Therefore, going to trial with me pleading not guilty because of the charges that were brought against me were not correctly defined, meaning they constantly said I was in cahoots with Scott, scheming to steal from people, and that's not true. Even though they were not correctly defining their accusations against me, especially considering that I would be most willing to plead to the wrong behavior and crime that I did commit if the prosecutor would but change the indictment to fit what I did do. And he did change the indictment. It's still fraud, and I deserve to go to prison or anything else that they want. I'd be glad to give you this if you would like a copy. And I would just like a copy back just so I know that I gave it to you.
I do.
We'll arrange that.
I do. We'll get
you. Yeah. But that, I wrote that out for my attorney because I thought the day I wrote that, the night before, that I was going into court to start my trial. And I was going to defend myself against those things, knowing what they were going to be, because I'd been told, you don't want to go into that trial room because Scott is going to testify against you. I never believed that Scott would testify against me. I never believed that he would accuse me of knowing all this stuff. And once I found out that my belief was wrong, I mean, I'm trusting that my attorney is telling me the truth and that the other attorney is telling him the truth, that Scott is ready to do that in order to reduce his sentence, that was very disheartening. And so I said, this is silly. I know that I'm guilty and I should go to jail, but not for conspiring to defraud these people.
What did you plead guilty to doing? What do you admit to?
I admit to defrauding them by not telling them that I had set up a line of credit with Scott. Had they known that, many of them would not have done business with him. I believe Ken Miller might have still done business with him because he'd done business with Scott for years and years and years and had given Scott his money, and so did other people. I don't even know who's here for sure. Most of these folks, I've only met once or just met him on the phone. But I did defraud them. They did not know that I had this stupid thing set up with Scott. My secretary, I defrauded her. I didn't tell anyone, not a soul, that I had set that up. And when I was being first interrogated by the FBI, they said, what made you think you had the right to do that? I said, I never thought of it, of having a right. It was Scott's money. He was holding this money for these people all this time. He needed a line of credit to do better loans so they would have better loans to get into. It didn't seem, believe me, I'm smart enough to know that it's walking out to the edge and it could be over the edge. I knew enough to know those technically, but I did not see any risk. here's a man that I had trusted completely, a man of high integrity, I believed, and all these people thought that he was a man of high integrity. And not one person who ever came to see him who was mad at him, who was claiming they wanted to find out what kind of scam he was running or whatever, every single person that I ever knew that came in to see him, some of them mad as hornets, walked out ready to give him another $1 million. I never saw anything other than that. And I never saw the banking commissioner ever come through the doors. I wish they had. I would have loved to show him what I was doing. And never saw you folks, but neither do I expect the SEC to be coming through the door. And then I never saw the FBI. I never saw anybody, and yet I knew he had had many attacks, but I assumed that the letters, I even helped him edit some of them, did the job, that they believed him. So I believed he was fine.
What letters were you helping him draft?
He had gotten letters from possibly from the securities, possibly from the banking. I can't remember which ones, but he would show them to me and say, I've got to reply to this in 10 days or something like that. And he'd say, I'd like you to help me compose it. And I'd say, well, why don't you write out, he used to use Dragon, and he would do a rough draft by speaking out what he wanted to say. And then I would edit a letter out of that. And then I would bring it down to him, and he would then edit the edit. And then eventually he would just take it and say, I think that's good. And then I would just go back to my office and work on whatever I was working on.
Yes, I thought you were asking a question.
I'll wait.
So you sit here today and say that you pled guilty and you feel that you're only guilty because of the line of credit that you established. And that's how the fraud was perpetrated.
That is the fraud that I perpetrated. That's right. And I stated that they changed the indictment, or they don't call it the, yes, they called it an indictment, and then they changed it to a sub-something. They had a funny word to it, and then I did a plea agreement based on that.
Do you feel that you were guilty of any other wrongs throughout, besides establishing this? Do you
considering, feel like no, I mean, this was the major thing that caused these people to lose their money. If I hadn't set up the line of credit, if that hadn't been available to him, it was just giving him the key to the funds, he could not have perpetrated. He could have done something, a few things. He might have done 2, 3, 5, 10, maybe, you know, maybe 20 million. I don't know what he could have done on his own, just fooling with people's money for short periods of time, but he couldn't have done what he did.
Is it your opinion that the creation of CLNM and the agreement that accompanied it, the $10 million discretionary line of credit, is that when the fraud began, in your opinion?
No. From reading his testimony, I would say he was defrauding people forever, but only in minuscule ways. I mean, in that he would take, I'm guessing, from what he said, he took one person's money to pay somebody else's monthly payments. I mean, he said it. He called it stealing in his own testimony before the FBI. Yes, I stole money.
So you said
it was the first time I ever heard any such thing.
So you said you feel it was on a minuscule level prior to CLNM, and this discretionary line of credit is what allowed it to
go to
greater
insane. So I feel like I'm, if it wasn't for me being stupid enough to do that, and he couldn't have done anywhere near the damage. Most of the people here would never have been hurt, and my friends might have been, because they would have come in. I don't know how the, you know, I keep hearing this business that in a Ponzi scheme the last one in is the safe guy, or the last, I don't know who gets hurt.
So did you have several relatives that were lenders or borrowers? Did you have several
friends? Yes,
or any of your relatives?
My relatives are poor.
So none of your relatives
live in
were
trailers
lenders
and stuff like that.
They were not lenders or borrowers.
No, not, none of my. I don't think any of my lenders. I'd have to think, but I don't believe I have any lenders, other than my wife.
Or borrowers.
Or they. I don't think either one. Yeah.
I want to talk in greater detail about this line of credit. Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with the document that we talked about at length? And Mr. Chandler, you also have an evidence called the Noden series.
Yes, I wrote that.
How does this coincide with the discretionary line of credit?
Because I had given to my attorney on one occasion a whole box of yellow sheets of paper, which represented every time I sent out a line, an SDLN under the line of credit.
Explain what SDLN is.
It was a drawer on his line of credit, and we had, Scott had called it SDLN by saying it's Scott David Loan, LN meaning loan. So that's how I would identify it on an Excel sheet. So whenever he'd call up and say, I want $100,000 sent to Gould & Burke before noon, I want $50,000 sent to Financial Resources, which is an SDLN, and I want $42,000 going to contractor A, B, and C, who have just finished a project in Massachusetts, you'll be getting wiring instructions. So I might get that kind of a thing. I would send it out, and I would label the part that was going to Scott as SDLN, and then I'd put in the amount. And every one of those sheets, by the way, every SDLN, my goal was to have a separate note in series written up for each one. And in the early stages, I'd meet with him after 3 months or 6 months, and I would have him sign, you know, 100 of those sheets. And then I would fill them in as we went, but it just got out of hand. I just stopped filling them in. And then when this happened, I realized that I needed to update that. I knew that it was over $10 million. And so I said, I will add it up. If you will trust me, sign this note. So he signed the note. And then I proceeded that night to add them all up.
So he signs the note. It says here, this is the date, November 5th, 2009.
That would be the date, because that was just 5 days before it all collapsed.
So the note was updated at the very end, and that's where this came into play.
That's right. I wanted that in case he died. I would be able to file a claim against insurance, and I would be able to file a claim against the so-called millions of dollars of assets that he supposedly had.
And attached to that note in series, like you explained, is an Excel sheet of every dollar accounted for.
I did the date
that he had requested it from you.
I went through all my Excel sheets. I started with June 1st, 2005, and I just set up my computer over here, and I just went down item by item. Every time I find an SDLN, I'd put it in and put a date beside it, and I went through the whole thing.
For what reasons would Scott contact you and need money from the SDLN loan?
I couldn't tell you all the reasons that he would contact me. I just could tell you what he called me for and what I sent out.
What different scenarios would he request money on this line of credit?
Well, again, he didn't give me an explanation. He had a line of credit. So if he said, I need $50,000 on this particular date, or he didn't say on this date, it was always that day, and he'd tell me by what time it had to be done. And it was in conjunction with that. He was giving me those orders along with probably 5 to 10 other wiring orders that same day, or checks that had to be written.
But we talked at length during our interviews about the fact that you had told me earlier, correct me if I'm wrong, that some of these monies were requested by Scott because he needed a little bit of money to close a loan.
The purpose of the thing, the whole purpose of us setting it up was so that he would have access to funds to quickly close a loan. Let's say a $300,000 loan was going to close on Wednesday. He would, on Tuesday, say, wire me, I need $72,000 to close this $300,000 loan. So I would wire out to $72,000.
And then
in the early days, he would even tell me the name of the borrower, and I would stick that in beside it if you look on the early sheets. As time went on, it got to the point I couldn't even keep up with who it was.
So in a scenario where he already had lender money for $180,000 and he needed $200,000, he would call you and say, I need $20,000 to close this loan.
I need whatever it was. Whatever he needed for the closing.
And then at some point, would he find a lender to replace that money that
you
had sent?
Yeah, then the lender would be sending in the $300,000. And the problem is I didn't have any way to... I mean, that $300,000 would come in along with $50,000 from another person, along with $78,000 from another person, along with...
Sure.
You know, there would be in a day 20 to 30 very substantial checks that would come in every day. So I would throw them in there along with the borrower checks that were coming in, and we would fill out some... One of the gals would add them all up, and I would just check it. I always did it on my Excel and checked it to make sure that the balance was right. They'd bring it down to the bank and deposit it. I didn't have time at that time of the day to go wondering, is that $300,000 a part of SDLN that went out last week? And Scott was always going to meet with me and just match him up, but we never did. It just never
happened. So you had intended to credit back.
I intended to give credit, and that's why the loan shows that we owe $220 million, when in reality I think it's something in excess of 10, but certainly not 20, because there was paybacks I just didn't give him credit for. He would, and it would really require him to look at those Excel sheets. I wouldn't have the foggiest way to figure out who was who. But he had the ability to tell me just by looking at something 3 to 4 months later.
I want to give you some documents that I had shown you this morning, and I just want you to have them in front of you so you can reference them. And yeah. You have them in evidence as well, so I will give you Mr. Chandler a copy. And I'd like to give... You need to take a moment to review them and refresh what we had spoken about.
Yeah, I remember you showing them to me.
What do those two documents purport to be to you?
With the first one.
Because of our conversation, it looks like... I don't remember this at all. As I told you in our meeting, this is... And it's dated the day or the few days after supposedly Financial Resource... I mean, CLNM was founded. But it supposedly is...
So what's the date on it?
The date is June 6, 2005. I started the company June 1, 2005.
What does that document purport to do?
Well, it says it's a purchase and sale, and it says that the seller is Financial Resources and that the buyer is CLNM. And that the seller is selling something of value from a Creative Courier Concepts, a New Hampshire corporation, and personally guaranteed by an Anthony Trione, president, and secured by UCC filings, plus a mortgage securing a promissory note from Anthony on his property located on the northwesterly side of a Seminar Road in Meredith, County of Belknap, New Hampshire, dated December 9, 1997, and recorded in the book of such and such, for a purchase price of $730,000.
So basically, the way I understood that document was, that was FRM selling their interest, their $730,000 interest,
yep,
to CLNM.
Yep.
And in the third page of that document, or maybe the second page, is that a schedule of payments?
That's what it looks like. Yeah, that's what it says.
Purchase, is that your handwriting? Payments.
That's my handwriting.
So what did that tell you? That you that
tell CLNM? Me that he said to write this down, and I wrote it down.
So CLNM, apparently, according to that, paid off that $730,000
yeah.
to FRM?
Yeah, and I'm even saying paid in full.
And you sign it.
And I signed it, yeah. I can see that.
Now, I wanted you to see that again, because tell me, the reason why I bring that up is because in the note in series, the other document that you don't yeah. have in front of you, I can give you if you'd like to see,
yeah.
those amounts paid by CLNM to FRM, those yeah. amounts paid are also reflected as a liability you say Scott Farah owes you individually. Do you remember recording it on your Excel spreadsheet as a loan to, you said, SDL loan?
That is for real. This, I don't know what it is.
So you've never seen that purchase and sale agreement prior to? But you said
I had to have seen it. I signed it.
And
it was put in front of me, and I signed it. I can see it right here.
Did you remember the amounts that are written, the amounts written there? You don't remember transferring that money to FRM in payment of that loan?
I never did. I'm sure I didn't. It would show on my Excel sheet as having gone out.
It does show up on here. On the same
yeah,
day.
But it went out as a loan. And then it's again repeated over here for $4 million.
And that's what I was going to get into next. The next
yeah.
document purports to be a $4.1 million sale of a note
yeah.
from Boston Hill
mm-hmm.
that was sold by FRM to CLNM for $4.1 million. Attached to that,
yep.
which you admitted was in your handwriting, was a schedule of payments where yep. by the mid-2006, a yep. year and a half later, CLNM paid in full that $4 million note
I
through wire
it.
Transfers.
Yes.
And again, do you remember when we lined up those amounts?
I know, they are. They add up.
Note in series.
I agree.
So what's the consistency? What's your take on this?
Just what I said to you before, I have no idea.
No idea.
No idea. I obviously signed it.
And at Scott's direction?
I'm sure. I couldn't have made this up on my own. I wouldn't have even thought of such a thing. So it's something that Scott had put in front of me right on the early stages of having formed the company. And this is, if you'll notice, all the dates on here.
Yes.
This is dated July 10th. Look at the dates, October 5th, of, how about May of 06? I mean, I certainly didn't, these didn't exist at the time that this was done.
When was the first payment dated? The very first payment on that note. I don't have it in front of me, that's why I asked.
He's got one for July
05.
14 of 05, I think.
So the first payment was made about a few weeks after the note was.
And this one is June 18th of 05, $200,000. That's even before. Oh, wait a minute. No, June 5th, June 1st.
This is all after the purchase and sale agreement. What my understanding of reading those documents is the first payment on that that purchase was made within a week of the purchase and sale agreement's date. Am I incorrect in that assessment? Do you understand what I said?
No, I don't understand what you said.
You told me that it seems that the payments on the note were made a while after the purchase
and
sale.
Well, some of them were right immediately then.
Immediately, so they began paying immediately.
Yeah. But this says on here, I mean, I think it says. Oh, I see. It says $4 million to be paid in no less than quarterly installments over a period of 36 months. Interest rate of zero.
Other than during today, you have no recollection of that document?
No. I don't.
But you do, in fact, admit that it was your handwriting?
Oh, it's my handwriting, absolutely. And I'll bet if you go and look in the files, you're going to find, you could find lots of documents.
You would agree those documents
I signed
pretty them. Unique, in fact, in
it
that
is.
It's right around the creation of CLNS.
Yes. Yep.
Do you have any idea about the $4 million Boston note or any idea as to its real value?
No.
So it's the first time you ever hear of it, this note being sold through CLNS?
I guess. I would have said, if you said, did you ever buy any notes? I'd said, no, never.
And you would record any money Scott requested on this note in series?
Yes.
On your Excel sheet, you would record the date that Scott asked you to send money to wherever he told you to send it.
I put those down faithfully because I expected that if he died on one of his silly trips to Africa or some other place, and I would need those sheets in order to be able to recover money for the lenders and to make up for the line of credit and to make up for mistakes that would be made in just handling all the stuff that he handled. I don't know another person that could have done it.
At least three out of the four transactions that you recorded on your spreadsheet, they're dated June of 05 and July of 05. There's four transactions. They total the 770 that happens to total that particular note in front of you. The first one, a Creative Couriers. If you turn around to that transaction, read me the very first payment and the date it was made. Just
June 18, 2005.
June 8, and the next one?
And that was $200,000. And then 7-2 of 2005.
For $200,000?
Yep.
See, Mike, what I found is that within a day or two, that the same amount was recorded to you as a liability going out to FRM. Where did you get these numbers? If you don't remember that document, where do you remember starting this, the very first time you ever asked you for money? Did you record it in...
It's on the Excel sheets, wherever they are. If I had those, I don't have a recall. If you show me the Excel sheets, I can show you every payment, and it would be on there. Whatever those dates that are on there should be on my Excel sheets.
So you know that you would have put it in your Excel sheet when he asked you for money, but
if
you don't
did,
have a recollection of putting it on that purchase and sale?
No. No.
One moment, please. So you admit that you forgot to make credit backs, or you were unaware of what should have been credited back to this note in series, so the value isn't really $20 million, it's less than that?
Oh. That's right, because I never had a way of recording the actual funds that came in for those closings, of which he used an SDLN for, and later the funds came in. I had no way to give credit for that, so those were never credited. The only thing I credited against him was actual payments he gave me.
And did he make actual payments on that note?
Yes. Yes, he.
Roughly how much did he pay back on that note?
I believe it's something less than $2 million. I believe it was $1 million. I remember a $500,000 on one occasion, another $300,000 on another occasion, maybe some $200,000 amounts, and then some smaller amounts. Whenever I would complain, he would generally very soon come up with some cash and pay it to me.
And how did you reflect that on this particular note in series? Did you erase it off the Excel sheet?
I put it in as a minus amount of loan. So I stuck a positive number in the Excel sheets for the loan, the SDLNs, and then I put it in as a minus. So that $20 million does reflect the payments that were made.
But it doesn't show it on this actual spread. There's no minuses on here. So that was done somewhere else.
I think.
Because there is no minuses on here, as if there were credit back.
No, you might be right. Maybe I didn't then. Maybe I
didn't actually credit anything back, or didn't do it on here?
I just didn't do it on that sheet. I was just getting an idea of how much had he was his line of credit. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't under.
So when Scott would request money on these lines of credit, he would ask you to send it to Financial Resources bank account?
Most of the time it went to Financial Resources bank account.
Where else did it go?
Well, he might have called up and said, I want you to send money to do a closing, let me just say, in Texas. If he had a closing in Texas and it was going to need $75,000 and he didn't have the lender yet, he might say, put that in as an SDLN. So I would send it out to an attorney in Texas. And then if he had a closing in some other place, we did probably, you know, every week, two or three that were out of town. And
so it went to Financial Resources bank account. It went to out of town accounts.
So therefore, there'd be out of town attorneys. I would send them to
where else would it go?
He might have a plumber that needed to be paid for a project that he was partners in. In Massachusetts, I remember one project went bad. He took it over. I even think Harry Bean got involved. He tried to sell it to Harry Bean. I'm not sure about that. But I do remember him having to deal with contractors down there. So he might have said, send this plumber $15,000 or $20,000 or $100,000, whatever the number was. And I would send it, and he'd say, the plumber will call you and give you his numbers, his bank account numbers.
Did you ever send it anywhere else besides for plumbers and different projects?
I don't recall.
Did you ever send it to, say, send $100,000 to my wife? You ever say anything like that?
No.
Or to SMM Realty Trust?
Well, he might have said, send this to SMM, a certain amount to
SMM. Identify what that is to you.
SMM is a trust it means Susan, Matthew, and Mark. Susan and his wife, he had set up an estate plan for them.
Scott and his wife?
Scott set it up for his wife and his sons.
Okay.
And he said, this is my personal trust. So if he told me to send some money to SMM for whatever reason, I would have put it in as an SDLN, and he would have told me, put it in as an SDLN.
But you do, in fact, remember occurrences where you would send wires to SMM.
I believe that there may have been wires to SMM.
Is it your testimony today that the bulk of these transactions were sent to Financial Resources bank account?
Yes.
One number sticks out at me because it's way higher than any other wire sent out. On August 3rd, 2007, $1 million wire was not sent to FRM, according to the testimony and my having spoken with the auditor for Bill Connor.
Yep.
Testified that he could not see that million coming into the FRM bank account. Where did that million go?
I don't know.
You'd have to give me election?
If you give me the Excel sheet, I could tell you.
Not this sheet, but rather a sheet that
not
you have.
Not that sheet. You have to look at my, it's on my, I gave it to my attorney to give to the FBI, who then I think gave it to everybody.
But that's where you'd be able to track that down.
Yeah, it would be on there. It would even say, you know, a name, and then I would be able to tell you who it is.
One moment. Just want to make sure.
I understand this document was updated on November 5th, 2009. right before the closure?
That's the day, yes.
What was before this? Did you already have another note in series with a lesser amount? Was it just this $10 million?
No,
Was there anything between these two documents?
The initial loan was set up for $4 million. Then 6 months later, I'm meeting with him to get the paybacks. And he's saying, well, we're going to go over $10 million easily. And so I said, well, then we should change it. So I changed it to $10 million. Then the next time that I realized that it was underfunded was probably in the spring or summer of 2009, in which I realized that we hadn't even paid it, had no meetings on it, not done anything with it. And then by the time this day occurred, I figured somebody's going to shoot him if I didn't. And I knew that, and if he died, there was a $10 million policy that would be able to go a long ways to making people whole. And so I wanted him to sign a promissory note so that I could at least go after I already had the life insurance assured, I thought. My attorney tells me I would have been in jail because of killing him if I'd have done the shooting. So, that's when I knew that the amount was bigger than $10 million, but I didn't know how much, and I said, would you please sign this? He was getting ready to take off, and I recommended he take off. I said, I think you should. I think there's going to be people going to be
When did you realize that you, in fact, made mistakes in that line of credit documentation and that there was credit backs that weren't
It wasn't until it was all over and David Smith, my secretary's husband, started questioning me on the line of credit and saying, didn't some money come in from those loan lenders? And I said, you're right. And then my attorney brought it up and said, that line of credit of $20 million is too high. That's not really probably true. You probably have something less than that, and it could be as low as 15 or 10. I said, I always thought it was around 10, 11, 12. So it shocked me when I read out the number as $20 million.
So, but it started off as $4 million in June of 2005 at the inception of CLNM.
Yeah.
And then at some point it went up to $10 million. Do you remember how long it had gone by before it went up to $10
million? I don't know.
I asked that question because the document dated here I have is a $10 million discretionary line of credit.
That's
I was aware of it. I have not seen it, the $4 million.
I know. I don't know where that is. It's in the papers that I gave to him.
This $10 million is dated 6/1/05, which is right when CLNM was created.
That's
that
right.
$4
million, yep.
A loan you had extended to him prior to the creation of CLNM?
I dated it all back to the first.
So you backdated it?
I just backdated it, even though we probably didn't sign that one until it could have been November, December, January. I don't know when it was.
So the date 6/1/05 is reflected as the date that
line of credit was.
You remember, have you ever met Bill Connor?
Yes, he was the accountant for Scott.
Do you remember him sending to you, to CLNM, confirmations every year when he did his audited financial reports?
He probably did, yeah.
You know what the purpose of the confirmation was?
I don't.
Do you remember signing the confirmations?
Oh, if he sent a confirmation to me, I would have signed it.
What is the what does it mean to you, the confirmations?
I don't know. You'd have to show it to me.
If I were to tell you that there were confirmations that if you signed off on was confirming that CLNM was not owed any money by FRM, would that seem accurate to you? Meaning he would send these confirmations out because let's say he saw a lot of money coming in. Let's say Bill Connor saw a lot of money coming in from CLNM, these big checks, which were these wires.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I want to make sure this isn't a loan. I'm going to send a confirmation to CLNM. I want him to sign off, meaning you sign off, that none of these monies coming in were in fact loans. Does that make sense to you as what the confirmation could have been?
It could have been.
And so you don't have any recollection of that?
I believe you're correct that's what was on one of those confirmations that was stuck in front of me.
Do you remember questioning in your head this line of credit when you were signing that document each year?
No. I wasn't questioning the line of credit.
As a liability that potentially FRM owed?
Well,
because you're signing off that FRM doesn't owe you anything. So I'm just curious if it ever came to your knowledge that
that maybe FRM did owe you something and that you were signing this without realizing. Or maybe
no,
you did do it.
FRM did owe me money. That is for sure.
Then why did you sign those confirmations?
Well, when I say FRM, Scott, the line of credit was with Scott. And Scott put up all his assets. He said he gave me a personal guarantee. As far as Scott didn't owe, I mean, Scott owed CLNM money. So technically FRM didn't, but Scott did.
So when you were signing that confirmation, that's what you had in your head? Was this money borrowed to Scott?
That's why
you felt okay signing those confirmations?
Probably.
But you sent the money directly to the FRM business account? In many instances when it was requested.
Yes, because he would tell me to.
Did you ever send it to Scott Ferrer's personal account?
I don't recall it. He was telling me where to send it, if it was going to an attorney in Texas, or if it was going to Goulden Burke, or if it was going to financial resources, whatever it was, he would tell me where to send it.
I'm going to ask you some additional questions, and mm-hmm. they may seem like they're jumping around, but I wanted to make sure, and I reviewed my notes, and I wanted to make sure I hit a couple of points. I'm going to ask some questions that you might think are random.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in sequence like the password.
Are you at all interested in knowing the actual paybacks on the line of credit?
Sure. We certainly appreciate the document that you'd like to enter into evidence.
Yeah.
I'd want you to look at it.
Allow me to look at it and see if it's relevant.
It's all the exact payments that were made back, and these are the actual totals of line of credit that was drawn each year.
No, you look at it and you represent to me what that represents.
One
How long are you going to be for?
I don't anticipate going very much longer. Another 20 minutes max.
Okay. Let's move along.
All right.
Did you create this document?
Yes, I did.
When did you create this?
I created it probably within weeks, no more than a month after everything collapsed. I wanted to see what the lines of credit were, how much did I lend out each year, how much income came in, what did I take out of the company. Everything that I have is that had to do with the finances of what the operating expenses were of CLNM. And if you can make a copy, I'd be glad to explain it. And then down at the bottom in the little box is where all the payments were listed, the actual payments, cash payments that he made.
The paybacks.
The paybacks.
So we started making payments back in November of 06, according to this document.
Yeah, I guess so.
The rest of it's a bit confusing to me, and I don't know if it'll shed. I don't want to not allow you to enter this into evidence in case I can gain a better understanding of this document later. What I would advise you, Mr. Chandler, is to...
I'm not going to accept it. And I'm not going to accept it because I don't believe the production of it meets with any recognizable accounting standard that's going to allow me to draw anything from it. If Mr. Dodge wishes to testify as to his perception as to what that means, I'll listen to that. But I'm not going to take the document.
Yeah, I'll be glad to.
So I'll give you the document, and I'll let you have the floor with what you want to say in regards to that document.
Tell me what that document says to you.
Well, what I wanted to know is one of the things that had been said in the press and other places or the FBI, I'm not sure where I read it or saw it, but they were saying that I was continuing to increase the line of credit. It was increasing. It wasn't increasing. It was actually going down. In June of 05 to June of 06, in that year, I took in a grand total of $27 million was the total gross annual income that I took in from lenders. And I gave Scott, he had drawn out $8.5 million under the line of credit. That's 31% of the dollars coming in went out the door into Scott's hands.
I'm going to interrupt.
Hmm?
You've already admitted that this constitutes a fraud on your part.
No, that's the line of credit.
This is a $10 million line of credit.
Mm-hmm.
And that document was utilized to perpetrate a fraud. Is that correct?
I don't think so.
Well, what was your testimony earlier?
My testimony was that that was a line of credit that I set up with Scott, and it represented the amount that we were going to borrow, that he was going to be allowed to borrow under it. It started out at $4 million, and then it needed to be changed to $10 million, and then it had to be changed later to $20 million.
Did CLM have assets of its own valued at $10 million at the time you signed this document?
No.
Where did you think you were going to, what were you going to rely on for the $10 million?
Whatever, I set up also at the bank. I set up a sweep account at the bank, in which they drew off my account, and then put it back when it was needed. And I set up a line of credit with Scott, in which he would draw off from it, and put it back when it was needed. That was the purpose, and that is.
I understand the purpose.
Yeah.
What's the source behind the $10 million?
I've never thought of it.
Other people's money.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, that's what it ended up being. That's right.
So, in other words, you didn't have, if you will, to be very simplistic, a bank account.
No, I didn't.
$10 million that belonged to CLNME,
that's right,
upon which he could draw in order to fund projects.
Right.
So, how is this any different than your testimony that Mr. Farah was paying people with other people's money? Is this any different?
Well, I believe I should go to jail. I believe I'm guilty.
So I understand this, and I'm not sure that I really need too much explanation on that chart.
Well, this is exactly how the money went out, and this is exactly the amount of how the line of credit went down, and including the payments. I mean, I don't care whether if you don't want it, I don't care to give it. You asked me what were the payments. Can you give me an idea what was paid? And I've got it here.
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to ask one additional question with regards to that paper, and then I'm going to reserve a couple of minor questions after I give you the opportunity to question. So okay. I just have one more additional question, and then I will reserve the rest for a moment at the end.
Okay.
I just want to know how you calculated the paybacks and the operating expenses and everything you used there. Did you said you put together that document after the closure of FRM.
Yeah.
How did you have access to the document, or how did you come up with those numbers? I thought that everything was sort of
I had put it all on a UBS, and I gave it to my attorney, and I said, I've summarized this for you, and gave it to him back in November.
So before you left in November of 2009, you had...
No, I didn't before I left. I took the UBS with me. I left my computer all there with everything on it. I didn't take anything off it, and I copied it onto a UBS thing, which I then gave to my attorney after I did this chart. So I wanted to see this for myself.
So prior to leaving and abandoning your office there at 15 Northview Drive, you put a USB device into your computer and took out all the documents.
The day that I left is the day I stuck it in there and took off the information that I would need in order to be able to answer questions. Because I didn't know if I would be allowed to back in the building. I had hoped and suspected that everyone would say, would you come up and show us where things are? And I would have gladly done it.
Did you take any documents with you other than that USB?
Yes, I took the line of credit documents because I wanted evidence of that. And I didn't want to leave it in there, and I gave that to my attorney. That's all the separate sheets. I gave him the life insurance information on Scott. I gave him the line of credit documents, the original of those. Gave him lots of things that I took that I wanted to be sure did not get lost. Those were evidence that I wanted to be sure that I... You got to remember, when I walked out those doors, I did not believe that we had done... I knew I had done a horrible thing setting up the line of credit, because I knew that's how the whole company was destroyed by Scott Dewing, but I did not know he had been out just flittering it away. I mean, I would not have believed it.
No further questions.
Okay. Mr. Dodge, you testified earlier that after you became aware of the impact of this line of credit, that you also came to realize that for years, Scott Farah was, in your words, paying people with other people's money.
Yeah, he said that he had been stealing from one person and using it somewhere. This is what was in his testimony.
Okay, and that's how you became aware of it?
Yes.
Okay. Reflecting back on your experience with Mr. Farah over the years, can you now see that process?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And I can see the wickedness, the evil, the whatever you want to call it, of my role in the thing. Even though I did not intend for anyone to be duped, I thought every person had a mortgage, that they could walk, that they could go after the borrower, and that they at least had some protection by virtue of the fact they had a mortgage. Little did I have any idea that there would ever be this bankruptcy court would come in and confiscate everybody's stuff. I thought the property law was the strongest law that there existed in the land. So I thought if a person had a mortgage on a property, including my wife and everybody else, if that property sold, those funds would go to that person whose name was on the mortgage. Never would in my wildest imagination that I would believe that this has happened, where everybody's stuff is dissolved as if it didn't exist.
I want to draw your attention to November the 6th, 2009, Friday evening, where you and your wife socialized with Diane Smith and her husband.
Yep.
And you're at, I believe, their home.
Like, no, maybe it was your actually, home. No, it was my home. We went to Uno's to eat something.
You're going
to
watch a movie.
Yep.
And you received a telephone call.
Yes.
And the testimony of Diane Smith was you were away from the room for a fairly long period of time.
Yep.
Did you return from that telephone call and were quite upset? With whom did you speak on the telephone?
I believe it was Scott. And I can't remember the dates now. All I can remember was a Friday. And that was the day I determined I was going to tell my wife and tell Diane that we just lost everything. But Scott was going to, he kept believing there was going to be some large sum of money still going to come in. And I told him I had no faith in that. And he called to tell me that he, that there was no hope and that he was leaving. I was already upset before I even went to that Uno's. Then we went from there and went home. And that's when I told everyone that it was all gone, everything was gone.
What did you mean when you said it's all gone?
Everything that they had invested. David and Diane had put their hearts and soul into the thing, and she had put her heart and soul into servicing the thing, and my wife's, everything that she had. And then all these people, all the people that I had known, have been destroyed by this.
Including people you didn't know?
Including a lot of people I didn't know, a lot of good people. Al Malkovin, when I heard him on the television, I couldn't believe what a decent man you are.
Following day, I believe you placed a telephone call to Mr. Bean, a close friend of yours.
I offered to kill myself in front of him. So called him up. And I was driving there with my gun. And if he wouldn't do it himself, I would do it for him if he wanted me to. And I get close to his house and I got a hold of him on the phone. I'm saying it's all gone. I'm telling him everything. I pulled over the side of the road. I couldn't drive. And he said, "God damn it. You better not kill yourself." I said, "You're the only person I know that could help me with this trouble. And on top of it all, I love you. If you know Harry, there ain't too many people in this world that have ever heard those words, ever." And he said, "And on top of it all, I'm not in New Hampshire, I'm in Florida." Oh, God.
Those two telephone calls.
Mm-hmm.
You knew, did you not, that what you had been participating in was nothing more than an illusion?
Oh, I knew. It was all a fantasy. It was stupid. It was just hard to believe that something that was seemed... It was just a fairy tale. It was just a dumb, stupid, unbelievable nightmare.
Do you look
nightmare.
Back and wonder why, when people would call your office saying, where's my interest check? Where's my money?
Yeah.
You now wonder why you didn't think at those times that this was an illusion?
I never would have believed it if someone had come in 6 months before and said, you're living an illusion. I wouldn't have believed them. I'd have believed that it's not true. I believe that what we had was the most stable, strong, good, healthy thing going. I couldn't imagine anyone doing a better job at brokering mortgages. I'm talking about Scott, what he did and the way he ran his company. It was unbelievable to watch him work. I never seen anything like it, and I never would want to see anything like it. It was more than I could comprehend. And my role, I thought I was doing an excellent job. I thought I was doing a really good job.
Do you now look back and think that you abdicated too much of your role to your staff?
Oh, well, not really. I'm not capable of doing that kind of stuff. I wouldn't even think that I could do administrative, but I can tell you what I can look back on, and it had Golden Omega never come in the picture, and we had APS or ASC or whatever it was from the beginning. I would have set the bank accounts up on there. And once that was done, there'd have been no room to do this. I would not have had the Excel sheets going on in one room and Diane out there with the software in another room, and the two never met.
But you knew as far back as 2006 that people were calling saying, where's my interest check? Where's my payment?
Well, there was always somebody that was going to complain, but there were very few. In 2006, there was very few serious problems. That's my perspective.
That's your perspective.
Yeah, because I lived in that little bubble, you could say. I didn't take the calls. Diane took them. She
But it was
endured.
Your company.
Oh, yes.
You were a loan servicer.
Yeah, no question.
Shocked to find out that some of these loans not only were not close to a loan to value, but
yes.
far exceeded the value?
Yep.
You shocked to find out that some borrowers who purportedly had received money never received a penny?
I know it. And I was showed up purchase and sale on the last day. This was done like a week or two before the thing closed. The FBI showed me a purchase and sale. They said, did you ever take somebody's money away from them? Did you ever sell someone's interest to somebody else and never give that person their money? I said, absolutely not. He says, well, can you look at this? And he stuck, just like you did, stuck a document in front of me with my signature on it and said purchase and sale. And it was a trust. It was a document that referred to a purchase and sale of an interest in a trust. And I remember Scott distinctly coming to me and saying, this man wants to sell his interest to this other person. Would you draw up the trust documents because the attorneys aren't here? I said, sure.
For 3 weeks, I listened to victims. And I characterized them as victims.
Yes.
And those people have universally said to me their contact was CLM with Donald Dodge.
Yes.
And almost universally in those victims, I've heard, where's my money? Where's my interest?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't the flags go up, Mr. Dodge?
No. I did not. I mean, I can believe that people are saying that, and I believe that there are people who did call and say those words, but I don't recall a massive amount. There was not a flood of phone calls coming in saying they hadn't received their interest. They got their money, their interest payments, on time because of the job that Diane did, and she took the flack on those kind of phone calls, and she might, if someone was really upset, she might forward them into me. And I would tell them, I can find out why you didn't receive your interest. But in almost every case, people got their money. They got their
their interest payments on time because the software and Diane and her end of it made those payments go out on time. The people that called in and didn't get their interest usually were calling in because their address had changed or they had not, they were expecting their interest in the first month of the year from the date of the loan when it wasn't going to happen until the second month because of the per diem, and they didn't understand that their payment wasn't going to occur, that they were being paid in arrears. But that was not the problem. The problem was when the borrowers called and said, where is the money that I've sent in an invoice for? And that's where I dealt with every day, was the borrowers complaining they didn't get their disbursement. And I'm sitting there trying to explain to them why I can't make that disbursement because they haven't given me the information I need to support their draw request. And that's what I spent most of my time dealing with. I don't think I ever took more than, in the whole 5 years, more than five or six calls like you're suggesting from people who said they didn't get their interest. What is heartbreaking is what happened on October, November the 9th, when everybody, it was all gone. It was their money had been stolen. Everything had been taken. It was gone. Been destroyed.
There were checks totaling $775,000 supposedly waiting to go out. Is that correct?
Oh, I don't doubt it. Because it was, that was the number that went out every month in that vicinity.
And the reality.
And we weren't there. I wasn't there to hear those calls. Unfortunately, Diane probably took an awful lot of those calls.
And Diane, her husband lost $435,000.
I know it. Biggest majority of their, they'd worked, and they worked hard. Well, not that everybody else hasn't worked hard for their money, but I know how hard. David is a very, he is not a spender, I guess. I don't want to call him tight, because I love him and I care about him, but he is the most frugal person I've ever seen in my life. And he saved that money out of a teeny-weeny salary over time and invested it and wouldn't touch it. And I know that that's true of most of you.
I have nothing further.
May I add just a couple of questions?
You may.
Mr. Dodds, were you aware that as part, well, first of all, were you aware that Pensco was used for the IRA portion of many of people's loans?
Yeah, and the one that tracked them down. Scott had met them somewhere out in some seminar and asked me to research them, and they were an excellent custodian.
When did you first use Pensco? What year?
It was early on, and I would say it was in 2005 still.
Were you aware that as part of the Pensco agreement, funds were not to be commingled? That was one of the things that would have been read prior to signing on with Pensco, is that all monies collected cannot be commingled. Were you aware of that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Did Diane Smith ever make phone calls or in any other way solicit lending opportunities to lenders?
No.
Never did she make a phone call. Even if there was a little bit of money left needed, would she call a prior lender and try to solicit them to lend into a particular transaction?
I don't think she ever. She isn't. She wouldn't be inclined to do anything for soliciting anything.
So she never made any kind of sales calls?
No. I don't remember any such thing. I didn't make any sales calls. I just took calls for Scott when he was out of the building. I would take the call, but I would tell them that I'm not the person they should be talking to.
Who had access to the checking account of CLNM? In other words, who could check the balance of how much was left in the account? Who had the authority to do that?
Myself.
So only you would see the balances?
I don't know what Diane could see. She could see, she would go in and do, she had stop payment authority, and I know she did stop payments. I don't recall, I don't know what her limits were, but I remember the gal coming up from the bank saying, what are the things that you want each person, and I was just at that time wanted to add Diane to it so that she could check on bounce checks and stop payment when someone claimed they didn't get their checks. There were lenders who said they didn't receive their checks that month. And so Darren would ask them that they had moved or some other thing, and she would ask them to hold off before we do a stop payment. And we will do a check to see if that check has been cashed, which it hadn't. And so then she would do a stop payment on it.
So she was charged with entering into the account online and seeing about these stop payments. But
that was, or if she needed to check out a check to see if it had been cashed. Let's say someone claimed they didn't get their money, but we did a search on the check and found that it had been cashed, it had been signed by the husband or whatever. Every now and then that would happen, and she would do that.
But as far as the account balance, if ever asked, it would be Scott asking you what the balance was, and
Scott
you would check.
Asking me, that's right.
So only you could see the balance, or you would see the balance as it went up and down over time.
Yeah, and if I left town, Scott would ask me to call in, and I forget how he did it.
So at any given time, though, at any given time, you could know how much was in the bank account, know how much was drawn on the line of credit, and essentially have a good picture financially of where CLNM was.
Well, I never, ever looked at the line of credit and added it up. I mean, I could look at it, and I could, you know, I could go through the process, but I never was looking at that and looking at this over here and thinking of the twain, the two, or their relationship to each other.
So you never, in looking at the overall financial snapshot of CLNM, you never considered that line of credit as how it would affect the overall viability of CLNM?
No, because I believe that Scott was solid, that he was, I believe that he was a wealthy man, that he refused to spend it on himself. He lived, he wore shoes that had holes in them. He had no interest in showing off money, and I believe that he was in all sorts of deals. And when he kept increasing the line of credit, I figured that the whole thing is growing bigger and bigger.
With respect to that line of credit, I have the $10 million one in front of me.
Yep.
It says that you're due 10% interest payable yearly, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever receive that interest?
I don't know.
No recollection of receiving the interest?
Well, I would have to go back to whatever I received, calculate the interest. I never did a calculation on it, ever.
So you have no knowledge as to that?
I don't know. My goal was that if ever we got everything running smoothly, that I would set up a system so that the line of credit could be monitored, and so that I would know how much he owed so that I could submit bills, invoices. I submitted all my invoices based on what the cost of the office was. I didn't base it on what I had earned. And so I never got to the point of calculating what I had earned and compared it to what my invoices were.
Who did the taxes for CLNM?
I took care of getting the taxes done, and I had I supplied all the ins and outs information to Phyllis Johansson at H&R Block, and she did all the K-1s. She did all the 1099s. Actually, we ended up doing all the 1099s, but they did prepared the K-1s.
Was that letter of credit ever made aware to the person doing the taxes that that existed? Was that
no?
Why wasn't that brought into the picture when you brought your documents to the tax? Wouldn't that figure in some way affect the tax?
Well, I believe it should have been on the balance sheet.
So but why?
I don't know.
So what made you not bring it with you when you're gathering everything to do the taxes in the first year? Mm. Why didn't you bring a document which was purported to be a major loan to another company? Why didn't you bring that with you?
As an asset.
Yeah, an asset, exactly.
Well, I didn't.
Was that a Scott's direction or your own volition? You chose not to bring it.
I talked with the attorneys and asked them how do they handle their escrow accounts.
Gulden Burke,
and they didn't know what I was talking about. I just said I wanted to know how they handled it. Did they keep a record of? Did they file that money coming in as income, and then declare the funds going out as expenses? How did they do that? And they said, no, it's just handled as a separate escrow account, and it's something to do with their attorney client. I don't know what attorneys have, but there's a thing with your association that you belong to.
But when you brought your documents to H&R Block, you neglected to bring this, and that was your decision.
I didn't want to claim that the income coming there was income. I only claimed the income that I had earned under the operating company.
And that was your decision to do that?
That was my decision.
Mr. Forsey, I'm going to ask you to suspend for a minute.
May I ask one additional question that came to my attention? I think it is relevant, and it has to do with your past, but I think it's relevant today. Have you ever spent time in prison prior to?
No.
Never have you been charged with or convicted of a felony?
No. I told a couple that I spent some time in the brig in my Navy days. That was for falling in love, not...
So you never spent time in prison for committing a crime?
No, but that's the person that I saw quoted as saying that I said I had been in prison.
No further questions.
And I have nothing further. Mm-hmm. Do you have any procedural matters of any kind?
No, sir.
Okay. The hearing is adjourned for today. We'll reconvene tomorrow morning at 10. Mr. Dodge, thank you for making yourself available to us today. I do appreciate the fact that you appeared here not under subpoena. I appreciate the fact that you answered every question.
Are we off the record?
Well, we are off.